This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The movie world may have come to glamorous maturity on the sound stages of L.A., but its roots, surprisingly, are intertwined with the American South. Influential and profitable movies like Gone with the Wind showed that film could be as culturally important as literature. But these movies and the segregated nature of the industry also propelled stereotypes and racism. Southern films narrated and documented Southern history. They also skewed it and, in some ways, even shaped it. Robert Jackson is an English professor at the University of Tulsa and the author of Fade In, Crossroads, History of the Southern Cinema, and his book zooms in on about 100 years of Southern film. He joins me now. Robert Jackson, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks for having me, Frank. Great to be here.
You start the book by introducing us to Annie Malone. Who is she, and how does she fit into this picture?
Annie Malone was an African-American woman who established a massive network of cosmetics franchises, and she was one of the first black millionaires in the United States, and eventually had a network of something like 75,000 employees. This was a global empire. And she actually was a filmmaker as well. And so I was very interested to see kind of how she, as a businesswoman, and especially as an African-American businesswoman in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, might have utilized this brand new medium of motion pictures. So I was sort of looking for evidence that she was, that she was using films as sort of industrial tools. She was using them to educate her customers and to build her network. Just seemed like a very interesting way to think about Southerners and film, because, you know, we associate the movies with Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation and things like that. But in fact, in the early days, there was a lot more creativity going into the relationships that people had with film. And this was especially the case in the South, where black and white Southerners were really quite innovative in the way that they're dealing with film.
Well, tell us more about Annie Malone and how she did sort of broker her power and influence, and what influence she may have had on the film industry.
Well, Ms. Malone was based in St. Louis, and during the Great Depression and even earlier than that, she had established a big network of franchises, and these would be often kind of traveling salespeople, usually women, she had offices in major cities like St. Louis and Atlanta and Memphis and New Orleans and places like that. But also in a lot of small towns, and so she had some films that would be used to demonstrate, sort of training videos, how her products could be used, and she also built this beautiful campus in St. Louis. It's been demolished in the last few decades, but she essentially created a college for her employees, and it included a school and a theater and did all kinds of outreach for poor black migrants who came to the city. And film and motion pictures was really central to how she got all that stuff done. So it's really quite an interesting case.
And North Carolina played a particular role. Well, let's start with Asheville and how it figures into the rise of the movie industry.
Yeah, this was a big surprise for me. But Asheville, North Carolina, out there in the mountains, was one of the major sites of early film production in the South. And we're talking about the days before Los Angeles has really consolidated its status as the capital of world filmmaking and American filmmaking, which would have been in the late teens, maybe around 1920, when that was a done deal. But in the first decade of the 20th century and then in the teens, Asheville became a great spot for filmmakers from New York to go during the winter time. It was warmer down there. The beauty of Western North Carolina was always a big draw for people. There were good rail lines that went down there from the East Coast. So the tourism and the mountains all played into this. And there was also a big fascination in turn of the century and early 20th century American culture with Appalachia. There's a lot of people who believe that the folks who lived down in western Virginia and North Carolina and West Virginia had been impervious to the modern world, that they had been there for hundreds of years without being exposed to any of the forces of modernity. And so this kind of curiosity and fascination with Appalachia became a big subject of early filmmakers, for good and for bad. I mean, there's some interesting early documentaries, but there are also these hundreds of hillbilly films that were produced, and really this is one of the reasons that Appalachia has so many negative stereotypes associated with it today.
Well, I guess that's one of the themes in your book, too, is that it, in many ways the South was hurt and shaped its image, or at least a popular image was shaped by some of these early films that then became echoes of themselves as the industry matured.
That's right. Yeah. The South, the late 19th century history of the South coming out of the Civil War and Reconstruction periods, and then with the establishment of Jim Crow segregation, which really took place in the 1890s and 1900s, around the turn of the century. This was kind of the legacy of the South in the modern world, for good and for bad. And it was happening exactly at the moment that movies were becoming commercial. So, most of the popular images of the South were stereotypes, and they were created by people who may or may not have had any Southern provenance themselves or Southern connections. In fact, there were a lot of Southerners involved in the business in the early days. But the popular images really included a lot of racial stereotypes, and stereotypes of white people too, white trash, Appalachian, poor whites, the common and very tenacious stereotypes of the South as being a place where, Americans are less educated and less intelligent. All of these things found their way into the movies exactly at this moment.
A lot of it, outsiders coming in with whatever prejudice they might have, reinforcing it, and then kind of spreading that word to the rest of the country. But other times, those stereotypes and images were created quite intentionally to stamp and brand an image of the South. H. Lee Waters, talk about him from North Carolina.
Well, Waters is one of the great history heroes of the history, as far as I'm concerned. He was a portrait photographer who had a little studio in Lexington, North Carolina, and was going out of business in the mid-30s because the Depression hit his community so hard. So he bought himself a little Super 8 camera and went out and started to document on film these communities, mostly in the Piedmont. But over the course of the next few years, he made documentaries of 118 different communities. And what he would be to come to town and shoot film of factory workers, textile workers, tobacco workers, kids going to school, storefronts, street scenes, things like that, anywhere that people were gathered, produce the film and bring it back a week or two later, advertising that people could come see themselves in the movies. And he actually made some money doing this, so he was able to support himself until the Depression loosened up in the early 40s. So it was 1942 when he stopped his filmmaking work. But these films have come down to us, and they're by far the best documentary record of Southern life in the 20th century. So it's really remarkable to see the way that, that a guy from central North Carolina was able to cut through many of the stereotypes just by pointing the camera at ordinary people. And this is why I think he's such a wonderful figure, because he's not dealing with the kind of stereotypes and caricatures of Southern life that you see so often in Hollywood filmmaking.
And as you say, he would take these films back to the communities where he shot them and allow folks to see themselves. Who else got to see these films?
Well, very few people. He sat on the films, and it's interesting, decades later, when he was an old man, he actually was part of a process of re-releasing some of these films, and they would take them to Kannapolis or any number of these places, Chapel Hill and Durham and Gastonia and many of the cities and towns around the state. And people would come out and take a look at the films from the 1930s and still recognize their parents and even maybe themselves as small children in there. They're very local documents. You know, it almost looks like home movies in a lot of ways. But because we have these films now, we can see a lot more, of the historical residents. We can see the way that education and employment patterns worked. We can look at the way that people had relationships across the racial divide, and that's a very interesting topic in Waters, and all kinds of basic aspects of community life in the Piedmont. So it's really quite something.
And then contrast his story, H. Lee Waters, with The Birth of a Nation, a very popular film and one that really transformed the film industry. And that certainly did a lot of damage.
That's right. Birth of a Nation came out in 1915, and it was a product of really the collaboration between Thomas Dixon, who was from Shelby, North Carolina, Wake Forest grad, and had been a minister and a lawyer, and wrote these extremely racist books and plays right at the beginning of the 20th century. And then D.W. Griffith, who was a son of a Confederate officer who grew up in Kentucky and made his way into filmmaking in the first decade of the 20th century. And they produced a movie that was really the first Hollywood blockbuster called The Birth of a Nation. And it's a very skewed and racist history of the Civil War and post-war period, telling the story of the rise and success of the Ku Klux Klan as this wonderful organization that's going to bring order back to the ravaged white South and destroy the black political gains and political participation that resulted from emancipation. And this was a film that was so wildly popular. It still may be the most successful film. It's difficult to measure its profitability over the years, but it's quite possible that this film made more money, adjusted for inflation, than any other film in the history of the medium.
No, but the one that comes close is another film that tells a story, a particular story of the South, Gone with the Wind. Of course, let's listen.
Ooh, just hold on and suck in.
Mommy, here's Miss Scarlet's pickles.
You can take it all back to the kitchen. I won't need a bite.
Oh, yes, and you is. You's going to eat every mouthful of this.
I'm not.
You put on the dress, because we're late already.
What my lamb going to wear?
That.
No, you ain't. You can't show your bosom for 3 o'clock. I'm going to speak to your ma about you.
If you say one word to mother, I won't eat a bite.
Oh, now, Miss Scarlet, you come on and be good and eat just a little,
no,
honey.
I'm going to have a good time today. And do my eating at the barbecue.
If you don't care what folks says about this family, I does. I has told you and told you that you can always tell a lady but the way that she eat in front of folks like a bird. And I ain't aiming for you to go to Mr. John Wilkes's and eat like a field hand and gobble like a hog.
Fiddle-dee-dee. Ashley Wilkes told me he likes to see a girl with a healthy appetite.
What gentleman says and what they thinks is two different things. And I ain't noticed Mr. Ashley asking for to marry you.
There's a clip from the 1939 film Gone with the Wind. I'm talking with Robert Jackson, author of Fade In, Crossroads, A History of the Southern Cinema. And, of course, there again we get what white folks would like the rest of the world to think the American South is all about, right?
I suppose so, yeah. Loyal slaves who care more about the family name than the white people that they're taking care of. Wealth and luxury and the sense of comfort. Back in the slave South when everything was wonderful and we were all better off. That's just a classic document of the lost cause and this kind of idea that the South was actually a wonderful place back in the old days when we still had slavery and everyone knew his and her place better. So that's 1939. You're getting this right on the eve of World War II, right? Black political pressure is increasing. The civil rights movement, it's going to be, you know, just around the bend. And you can see, even in the 30s here, this kind of anxiety about race relations that plays into a document like Gone with the Wind.
And very shortly, there is the emergence of the race film industry. Tell us about that and what kinds of films African Americans were making and when that began.
Yeah, well, you know, Hollywood was segregated, and this is a big result of the infusion of Southern talent and Southerners, white Southerners and black Southerners, out to Los Angeles as part of the migration out of the South. And the result of this is that black people really had very limited opportunities. You heard in that clip Hattie McDaniel and Butterfly McQueen doing what they could with the roles that they had, basically very derivative caricatures that they could make their living by in the Hollywood system. But most black people, and certainly black filmmakers, were shut out of that system, and especially if they didn't want to play, you know, along with the kind of racism that was going to be required of them. So they generated their own independent film industry, and this is what we now know as we refer to it as the race film industry. And it's basically kind of an indie tradition that exists alongside and in competition with Hollywood. So it's quite a remarkable tradition as well.
Now, more recently,
most of its films are lost.
Yeah.
And, sorry to keep going there.
None.
You know, but the few remaining documents that we have are really quite something.
And do we can we gauge their popularity? Kind of who was going to see them and what influence they might have had?
Yeah, that's difficult too, because movie studios like MGM and Paramount and Warner Brothers, you know, had developed these enormous theater chains, and they controlled distribution of motion pictures for at least up until mid-century, when the Supreme Court made them, you know, unload some of their stuff because they were monopolies. Black filmmaking, on the other hand, you know, was much more limited in what it could do in terms of distribution and exhibition. There may have been 100 or so black-owned or black-controlled movie theaters around the country, and indie filmmakers who were African-American basically had to kind of ride the Chitlin circuit, as it were, and get in these Jim Crow train cars and take their movies from town to town, trying to make a few bucks and break even. So it's a very, very skewed, asymmetrical economy, but still one in which they were able to produce a viable tradition.
I've only got about a minute left, but if you take us forward now to a film like Moonlight, it suggests that there is now some nuance in expressing the Southern experience, I suppose.
Well, Moonlight's a tremendous film, and I was happy to see that it was acknowledged with some awards. An independent film produced in Florida just in the last couple of years, and documenting the life of a young man who is poor and black and homosexual, right? So material that, you know, generally wouldn't be seen anywhere on screen in the Hollywood tradition. But these days there are a few more opportunities for independent filmmakers to be generating interesting images. And because this is still part of the South that's not really well known, it really came across as a wildly original idea. And the imagery of Miami, especially parts of town that haven't been seen on film widely before, really came across as strikingly original.
Robert Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank
you. Robert Jackson's a professor of English at the University of Tulsa, the author of Fade In, Crossroads, A History of Southern Cinema. On the State of Things today, we will preview a new play, Yes to Nothing, that follows four women in the Midwest punk scene, follows them across two decades. Stay with us.